COVID-19 has forced businesses and employees across the globe to rethink what it means to go to work.
As we return to some sort of new normal, how do we ensure that that return is equitable?
Stay tuned for a special branded episode of Global Translations, presented by Citi, January 27th.
Well, Louisa, we've done it. We're finally here.
No, don't say it.
We're at the second to last episode of the season, the last one we're hosting together.
I cannot believe how fast it's gone by, and there's been so much breaking news every single day. But you and I have been trying so hard. We've been trying to keep our focus on the big long-term forces that are shaping our lives, the global economy. We talked about supply chains. We talked about critical minerals.
Don't forget labor.
And labor, which is jobs.
And now...
don't say it.
It's the final countdown. Alrighty. There's nothing more critical to the sustainability of our societies than our ability to ensure meaningful work for everyone who wants it. As labor markets respond to the pressures of digital revolution, climate change, and COVID, we've seen there's a real need for reskilling and upskilling and other innovative approaches that prepare people for these new and changing jobs.
I mean, Ryan, that all sounds good, but I feel like we've been having the same conversation. We've been talking about this since the 90s, since the dawn of NAFTA and the rise of free trade, letting China into WTO, all of that when manufacturing jobs were moving overseas. We kept hearing about reskilling and retraining, and we had programs like trade adjustment assistance to help workers move to new industries. But it feels to me like we never really solved the problem. And we can see that reflected in today's politics. There are many people who feel left behind due to these big wrenching changes in the global economy.
Right. But the change isn't going to stop. That's the reality.
Totally.
And now, instead of wrenching upheaval because of offshoring, mm-hmm. it's because we are having millions and millions of businesses closed.
Totally.
We're shifting to remote work. So the change is going to keep coming, and we're going to have to keep facing it.
Well, right. And in the last episode, we heard from workers who've experienced these big changes firsthand. And we talked about some of the policies and initiatives that supported them at the state level and in the small country of Singapore. But that's just not big enough. So today we're going to talk about large-scale solutions and also what we've learned over the last few decades of grappling with this about what it really takes to get results.
From Politico, this is Global Translations. I'm Ryan Heath.
And I'm Louisa Savage.
COVID has accelerated the impact of the structural defects in the pre-pandemic economy.
This is Zoe Baird. She's CEO and president of the Markle Foundation.
The structural defects include racial barriers, the decline in the role of unions, other inequities in the economy, and of course the acceleration of the transition to a digital economy. So all those forces have come together to really hammer the people at the bottom of the pyramid, low-wage workers, which are heavily people of color, workers with limited post-secondary education. So the state of our economy is in dire need of addressing the challenges of equity. And in fact, it's my view that the recovery will be measured by whether it creates greater equity as we come out of this current economic situation.
Markle runs the Rework America Initiative, which brings together a variety of organizations and companies to scale job training and reskilling programs at the state and national levels.
Zoe, can you tell us a little more about what Rework America is and how the program goes about giving those opportunities?
The people most acutely in need of structures to help them get back into the labor market and back into better jobs, not just the low-wage, insecure jobs they were in before, are people who have the least training, the fewest credentials to offer in the marketplace. And so what we did when COVID hit, and we already were working against these forces in the marketplace, but when COVID hit and the crisis became so acute, we put together the Rework America Alliance to ramp up our work to meet the scale of the challenge.
This alliance includes major corporations, civil rights groups, and small businesses. Groups like Boeing, Google, online course provider edX, and the National Urban League, just to name a few.
The intention of this group coming together is to identify for those jobs that people have lost, what are the adjacent jobs with higher wages? What are the jobs that are going to come back that we can help people get into, both by showing the skills they have from the jobs they've held already, and also by getting them rapid and affordable training to move into these higher wage jobs, so that as we come back out of this economic crisis for so many millions of Americans, they can stand up taller, have respected the capacities that they have to contribute to the labor market, and have much more stable jobs with higher wages and a greater prospect.
So when I think about all the digital change that COVID has accelerated, it feels like tech has moved from being this very vertical sector to something that's integrated across everything in the labor market. Does that mean workers now need to focus on improving digital skill sets?
They're not solely digital skill sets, but digital skills are clearly important. We put out a study called the Digital Blind Spot, which showed, this is before COVID, but it shows that the fastest growth in digitization in jobs was in low-wage jobs. Jobs like janitors that you just don't realize have had a change in the skills that are required. So digital skills are clearly very important, but just going out and getting a digital skill without knowing what job it's going to help you get is not going to be helpful for people who are under such strain already. And so we're trying to be very targeted in doing the analytics of the labor market. We've got great partners to do that in the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta and McKinsey. And then we're vetting that those insights with people who serve workers, with businesses large and small, so that we are able to tell people, you know, here's a job that's going to grow in the marketplace. If you've been a retail worker or if you've been a hotel worker, that these are the skills that you have from that job. We're creating a tool that will actually let people go into a coach or use it online if they can, enter the jobs that they've had before, and it'll give them a resume that they can use then to market as a skills-based resume to the employers who are hiring for the kinds of jobs that will give them higher wages and greater stability. For some people, that's going to be a gateway job on the way to their destination. So it'll be a job that is more promising in having a future than the job they had before. It may be a job at the same wage level, however, and from that second job with some training, they could then get into a higher wage job. So we're trying to show people that whole path that will enable them to be successful.
So it feels like this old binary between blue-collar work and white-collar work, it just doesn't really apply anymore. A lot of things have just become a gray zone. Have I got that right?
Right. I mean, the blue-collar and white-collar notion really created a hierarchy. And the truth is, what we've seen as we've come out of the recovery in 2009 or the recovery even in the last few months is that people in what have been considered to be those white-collar jobs are coming back to work much more quickly. For many of them, they never were out of work, whereas people who have been in what have been considered blue-collar jobs are the ones who've gotten hammered. But the truth is, there are so many great jobs in the digital economy that people can do. You know, if you are someone who learned to take apart a car engine in your neighbor's garage, you're a fabulous candidate to repair robots. So how do we make sure that people know that? And how do we make sure that people through that kind of learning, training, are able to move into these good jobs? If you're someone who's perceived yourself as a housekeeper, and maybe you have two or three people who work for you and you clean houses, you have extraordinary business skills. You're really running a small business. You're running payroll, you're running time management. Those skills should be respected in the kinds of jobs that are going to be available for people with decent wages and good benefits going forward.
So what's your perspective on some of these newer economic ideas, the sort of ideas that are perceived as radical in the US, but not necessarily elsewhere? I'm thinking something like universal basic income, the idea that Andrew Yang promoted in the Democratic primaries. Is there a role for ideas like that, or other ideas that support people to be more entrepreneurial and do more with their skills?
I think there's a role for federal investment in individuals. And I would hope that that investment in individuals could enable them to have greater market power and greater voice. So we have, for example, proposed an opportunity account, which would be training funding that the federal government makes available to people to use in programs where there is good data to show that it will help them get into a higher wage job, or where the programs are prepared to make transparent the benefit people get.
This is definitely shades of what we heard about Singapore's Skills Future program in our last episode.
We also very much encourage more employer training of their workforce, and federal programs that drive that can really benefit individuals. And I think, you know, what we're looking for is a marketplace where workers have dignity, where they have dignity regardless of the education they've gotten, but based on what they can do.
And the second point? Well, that also sounds similar to Marianne Wanamaker's take on a broad reskilling program from our first episode on labor.
And where people are supported by public institutions to achieve their potential and to have a fair shake and to have equal dignity. And all of those things, I think, are what people hope for and should still be able to achieve. You know, we should not lose sight of how the American dream is foundational to absolutely everything in this country, to our democracy, to our respect for each other, and to our sense of ourselves.
So let's talk about the next 4 years for a second. What's your expectation of the Biden administration? How will jobs fit into this theme of building back better?
Well, I think the new Biden administration will be very focused on unifying the country around a more equitable recovery. And that will be of enormous value. There are so many areas of potential job growth that can have broader public impact. Climate jobs, as you mentioned, infrastructure, care jobs. And as we make those investments, if we invest in training people as well, so people go into those jobs with stronger skills, then they should be jobs that are higher paying jobs, jobs where there is the prospect for labor representation. You know, I think there's just a great deal that we can do that will strengthen individuals as we bring back the recovery, and that we have to do that. We will have failed if we bring back an economy in the way we've done this before.
So I'm going to go out on a limb and say that an unequal recovery may be the biggest risk or challenge that you're confronting now. But you tell me, what are the biggest obstacles or concerns that you have going into 2021 as you try and spread these programs?
I think it's essential that we come out of this recovery with greater equity and a strengthened hand for workers and for racial inclusion. And if we can do that, which I believe we can, then I think we strengthen our very democracy. I think people will be less divided if everyone is together participating and contributing to our economic growth. I have every expectation we can do that, and I think we're in a very different moment than we've been in at any time before, and the requirements of us in this recovery are different than they've ever been before.
Zoe, thank you so much for joining us. It was a real pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We'll be right back.
With the COVID-19 vaccine rollout underway, many companies have begun to discuss how their offices will return to normal.
We make sure that as we slowly and carefully and in a data-driven way return to the office, we keep that individual humanity and empathy and understanding of circumstance so that that return is equitable and we don't inadvertently leave certain populations further behind.
I'm Heather Clancy. On a special branded episode of Global Translations, presented by Citi, we discuss the future of work, how the pandemic accelerated new workplace trends, and why an equitable return to work is essential. Tune in January 27th, wherever you listen to this podcast.
We've just heard from a leader in the job training and reskilling space in America. Now let's move across the Atlantic, where tech and startups are top of mind with our next guest.
Konstantin Vanaronje is the envoy for TechLeap.nl, which is
the accelerator of the Dutch tech ecosystem. So we do everything to support tech companies in their growth in the Netherlands and from the Netherlands internationally.
Konstantin and I worked together years ago at the EU, including on the need for European workers to update their skills. He was the chief of staff for the European Union Digital Commissioner, Nelly Kroes. I asked him how he's viewing the European labour market right now in the wake of the pandemic.
We're seeing that COVID has brought transitions forward in all disciplines, in all sectors. So even in education, healthcare, but in food delivery, in the energy transition. So, and all of these transitions, some of which were actually pending for years, like in healthcare, and also being pushed back because of lack of skills and legacy systems, etc. So if we now suddenly jump to these new ways of working, new business models, then that will have an impact, and they will impact on the skills that are required. So on the one hand, you see that there are many vacancies, and on the other hand, you'll see that people are going to lose their jobs and need reskilling. So reskilling is going to be a major theme, I think, in Europe.
Well, speaking of reskilling, let's dial it back a bit, back to the time we worked together at the EU, which is honestly getting on 10 years ago now. The way I recall it is that we were constantly stuck in a corner. We were trying to show that digital issues were larger issues that affect everyone, and that Europe needs more entrepreneurs and workers need more digital skills. Tell us, why is developing that skill set so critical for workers today?
At the time, it was critical because, one, there were already vacancies, so it's an economic loss, obviously, if you can't fill these vacancies. But we were pushing a digital transition that was going to create many more jobs. So we were actually solving one problem, the unemployment problem, but we weren't really solving it because the skills were just not there. So we're creating more vacancies that were hard to fill. So it was logical at the time that we would push for more coding and more other digital skills to be trained in formal training and beyond. And this is still the case. I think the massive transition still needs to happen. And it's not just in, you know, the Industry 4.0.
Industry 4.0, that's shorthand for the quote-unquote fourth industrial revolution. Jargon to describe the Internet of Things, the use of autonomous tech, and so on.
But it's in food, we'll see transition. It's in energy, there's a transition there. We see supply chains everywhere. Everything is driven by data. Everything has a digital component. More and more, it will be AI supported. So, and all these things require a different skill set. So the analog skills will be much less valuable, and there will be much more demand for digital skills.
So level with me then. How many jobs are at risk?
In the end, if you're talking Europe-wide, it will be millions of jobs at risk. So we'll see that on the one hand, you have a rise of unemployment now because of COVID, and those jobs, some of them, of course, will be filled again when the economy kind of picks up again, especially in everything that's, you know, bars and restaurants and hospitality. But in many other jobs, will require different skill sets. And we better now use the time, and governments better get prepared to support people in their transition to new jobs and new skills and new profiles.
What do you think the barriers are that are holding back leaders and officials from being more radical in restructuring how we learn? What is it that's actually stopping us from seeing that fact that we need to learn new skill sets and we need new institutions to get us there? And the reality that Europe and other places just aren't moving quickly enough to get there.
Well, I think there's the formal education. It's called formal because it is pretty slow in adjusting, and we still teach Greek and Latin. I don't know why we do that, but we still do, and we will continue doing that. Whereas we don't step over in doing digital skills and including that in the curriculum. And I think there's a certain concern about doing something new which doesn't hold its value. So learning French is probably useful because the French will continue speaking French. But if you're learning a computer language, though, there is this kind of understanding that you have to stay up to pace. But there's a misperception there, is that you don't learn a language, but you learn how to code. You learn the system of coding, which is like learning a language. And that should be taught in schools. And I think it's a certain fear about new skills, also about teachers not being fit for purpose anymore. They feel, I think, that their pupils know more about digital than they do. And there's a resistance in the system. And this could be also the educational content providers that don't really know how to adjust.
Konstantin insists that all of these factors are pushing against changes in learning.
And it's not just digital, it's the whole 21st century skills that have been there since the 21st century and have not been adopted. But then, and then there are countries like Finland and Estonia and Singapore, for that matter, and that have acknowledged these things and they have made the adjustment. So it is possible. It's possible in a open European style democracy like Estonia, because I think the leadership is very forward thinking and digital has been a part of even I think of their national pride and culture. And in Finland, the same thing. And in obviously much more top-down systems like Singapore, where they simply said, you know, we need these skills. And they told the teachers that they had to provide them and organize around that. And but that is much more top-down, which is, I acknowledge that that's more difficult in a European setting than it would in a country like Singapore.
So how much of this challenge boils down to mindset? As Constantine mentioned, there needs to be more flexibility in education and openness to being more entrepreneurial.
Well, teaching entrepreneurship is challenging because I think most of our teachers have the opposite profile from the entrepreneur. I mean, they are process thinkers, they are risk averse. Entrepreneur is really keen on knowing the outcome. So they are very outcome focused, more project minded and not process minded. They like risks. They want to understand the purpose. They don't understand why you learn Greek if you don't get to speak it because there's no classic Greeks anymore. So they want to understand why they're doing this stuff. And it's not just doing math because we've been doing this for, you know, hundreds of years. And I think education system is not very well adapted to that kind of personality. Of course, you can teach entrepreneurship. I know courses where kids actually build their business and build real business. I mean, they open a bank account and they, you know, build a business, which is really fun. And then you have obviously the simulations where you get a set of money and, you know, you start with the same basic conditions and you compete with your classrooms. And so all that stuff is really cool and it happens. But it's very marginal compared to the core curriculum, which hasn't changed in many countries for decades.
So what is access to capital like now in the Netherlands in light of the pandemic? And should government get involved in that equation? I mean, in a way they already are when they bail out old big companies, but it seems to me that just protecting existing jobs also leaves startups out in the cold, and it might even make it harder for them to create new ones.
I don't think it's a binary thing. I think you do have to do both. But if you want to bail out a legacy company, you'd have to condition it in a way that, like with the air carriers, you have to make the transition to more greening with fuels and to changing business practices. And at the same time, you have to invest in startups. And there is definitely a role for the government. Also, what we're seeing as the trend through COVID is that the volume of venture capital actually has gone up. So there's a lot of money that doesn't know where to go. You know, the stock exchange is very volatile. The debt, there's no interest anymore. So there's a lot of money seeking to go somewhere. But what we've seen is that there have been much fewer deals. So it seems like the existing funds are investing a lot in their portfolio companies and supporting those to come through the crisis in a relatively healthy form. And it means that there's not that much money going to new companies, which is sad, obviously, because there's a lot of opportunity there, too. So that's one phenomenon. What we're seeing as well is that there are different phases of funding where there's not enough venture capital available, or just basically the business logic is not there. The business case is not there. So, for instance, you see companies that have high capital expenditure, long-term time to market, they might actually get funding early on because there's still government money or there's subsidies and they're more research-based and they might find investors. But these investors will then value the company at a certain level. Then when the moment comes that they really have to invest in like pilot plants or when they have their proof of concept and they want to scale kind of at an industrial level, that just costs a lot of money and there's no revenues there yet. And there, that's the point where the market just doesn't step in yet and where a government could play a role, but you don't want government investment. You really want non-dilutive capital, so grants or maybe convertibles at very favorable rates. And actually, we're looking at that now with the European Investment Fund, also with the government to step into that gap. So it's really the high-tech companies that are capital-intensive, long time to market.
What could we do to make startups and the digital world more attractive, more feasible to people from less affluent backgrounds? You know, I'm thinking of people who might have that spark of interest, but they just don't really see the pathway of how to get involved in the field.
If we are growing the tech sector and the tech sector is only accessible by white male, high educated people, then we obviously failed miserably. So that's the negative. The positive side I see is that we're seeing incredible companies now coming out of Nigeria and out of all places all across the world that would have never had an opportunity to build these kind of companies when we didn't have the technology that was so democratic that like it's now. So it's more in societies there where we are seeing that. So not between countries, but in societies where certain groups are more privileged than others. And we need to be very careful that the privileged of today are not more, even more entitled in the future because of their starting positions. I think, well, awareness is the first thing. We need to be aware that this is happening. Two, yes, many people that are in this business are highly educated. But the education is not typical, in, as we said in the beginning, for formal education. So there are many courses you can do that you can actually leapfrog many of these, of the barriers that there are to the normal labor market, and by actually entering a startup and by learning how to code. And you can do all that because many people that have been through formal education have not learned these skills. So in principle, the tech entrepreneur could be someone from any background. But, you know, it means that governments need to acknowledge this. It means that governments need to provide more access to these alternative education forms. And need to support with money. It is just very, very apparent that, you know, you have to really give specific attention to this and create those opportunities. Otherwise, it'll not happen. Otherwise, this development will further exasperate the segregation that's already there, and it will only grow it. And that's a very bad thing.
Constantine, thank you so much.
Thank you, too. And be well.
In this chapter, we've gone from the bird's eye to the ant's eye view of the global labor situation. We've explored how technology's disruptive forces and the climate change imperative are affecting jobs like never before.
There are many ideas for how to save jobs, prepare workers for changing or new positions, and how to make structural changes with real effects for labor. This is going to be a central challenge for the Biden administration as it takes office, and for governments around the world as they grapple with the pandemic and getting workers back on their feet.
That's it from Louisa and me for this season of Politico's Global Translations. Thank you so much for joining us and sticking with us on this journey. If you love this podcast, we've got you covered. My Global Translations newsletter is free, and you can sign up at politico.com/go-global.
Our producers are Annie Reese and Kara Tabor.
Our senior producer is Jenny Arment, and Irene Noguchi is the executive producer.
I'm Louisa Savage.
And I'm Ryan Heath.
Thanks to Zoe Baird and Constantine von Aranier for talking with us. Global Translations is presented by Citi, a leading global bank.
Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and listen for a special branded episode from Citi coming January 27. Thanks for listening.